Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being with us today. Our guest both hours, Joe Heschmeyer. He has recovered from his time out here working with us in California, where we pretty much ran him ragged every single day he was here. And so now he's back refreshed, back home in the Midwest, ready to do 2 hours with us. And I'll tell you what, we want to talk to non-Catholics this hour. If you're not a Catholic, we'd like you to answer a simple question for us, and then we'll have a conversation. And this is always a lot of fun, and it's always just so encouraging too. We get to talk to a lot of wonderful people, many of our Protestant brothers and sisters will call, atheists and agnostics will call occasionally. Well, the last time I remember a Buddhist calling was a woman driving across South Dakota, said she was a Buddhist, which I to me, that seemed like a rarity, a South Dakota Buddhist. But anybody, if you're a South Dakota Buddhist, North Dakota Buddhist, maybe you're a Milwaukee Hindu, anybody can call and tell us why you are not Catholic today, and we'll have a conversation about it. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Our guest, as I said, both hours is Joe Heschmeyer. And Joe is the author of all kinds of wonderful stuff, including his latest book, which is getting rave reviews. The early church was the Catholic Church, the Catholic witness of the fathers in Christianity's first two centuries. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being with us and taking these calls.
Absolutely, my pleasure. I love that you talk about how refreshed and everything I am. Since I saw you in California, I had a 3-day parish mission in Wisconsin, and then I just came back last night from going on Matt Frad's show in Steubenville. So I feel like of all the times you could have mentioned to everyone how
you're wiped out.
I'm like, yeah, I'm slightly. I'm very, very happy to be doing this, but I also am like, oh yeah, my own bed. That feels pretty good. So it's exciting.
By the way, you've been kind enough not to mention my strange appearance, and I appreciate that. But every now and then, I got
to
wear this.
If I had to do that every time, that was applicable.
Now, Joe, it's very difficult to have conversations with you when you act like that. All right, I'm going to give out the number again, 888-318-7884. And every now and then I get these migraine headaches, and I got to wear the sunglasses in the studio. And it looks absolutely ridiculous. And it looks particularly ridiculous right now because I'm wearing your sunglasses, Joe. You left them in Zach's car when he took you to the airport.
And he said that they were cool and they were in the back of his car. I did not put two and two together and realize they were actually my sunglasses.
Yeah,
no wonder I thought they were so cool. I literally complimented the sunglasses. And it turns out they were my own sunglasses.
Yeah, I was wearing my sunglasses. And he goes, wear these. Joe will recognize them. But anyways, enough about that. And you know what, Joe? I have to commit myself to this when you are on. And I'm going to commit myself to it again today. I am going to do service. My life is acts of service for the next 2 hours for the listener and the caller. I'm not going to get involved in silly conversations with Joe Heschmeyer, which is one of my favorite things to do, and that's why I get bogged down. I want to have serious conversations with callers who are not Catholic, who call up and answer our question, why aren't you Catholic? And you can tell us. And, you know, maybe the answer is, I don't believe in God. Or maybe the answer is something to do with us Catholics and the way that we behave. Whatever it is, or maybe it's a doctrinal disagreement you have with us. Maybe no one's ever told you about Jesus and you'd like us to tell you about Jesus. And Joe and I will jump all over that if that's what the call is about, because we love talking about Jesus. I do, Joe. I don't want to speak to you, but I love
you can safely speak for both of us.
All right,
on that one. It is nothing better.
888-318-7884. 888-318-7884 is the number. If you're not a Catholic, though, all the lines are being held for you today. 888-318-7884. And it's funny, Joe, because I think here at Catholic Answers, you and I are at least among the folks who do in front of the microphone type work here at Catholic Answers, we're kind of in the minority. Do you know what I'm referring to?
It being cool?
No. Yeah, that's definitely, the two of us are definitely the only two cool people that, as you can tell by the sunglasses.
What about bearded?
No,
that's the minority.
No, we're not converts to the Catholic faith.
There were so many possible things. Yeah. You know, this is one of the classic, I'm going to get very nerdy here for a second, in educational theory, saying which of these doesn't belong in a set. Those kind of questions are really bad because the more creative a child is, the less likely they are to guess the answer the teacher wants. Yeah, because the teacher wants to be like, well, these are all four-sided and this one's three-sided.
Right.
But like a creative kid, it maybe notice all sorts of other differences.
Yeah,
like,
right. They'll go, well, three of them are colors of the French flag and one of them is not a color.
Exactly.
And you're like, wait a second. I thought it was shapes we were doing. Yeah, that's
right.
That's Sesame Street. Isn't Sesame Street awful? It's just awful for kids. One of these things is not like the other.
I'm not agreeing with you on that. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
maybe I went too far.
There, I saw a great version of it where they had like a multiple choice thing and like there were, I think, five different answers and four of them were obviously different in one regard. You know, it'd be like you know, four blue and one red shapes, and then four of them are squares and one of them's a triangle, and then the fifth one sticks out by not sticking out. Like, it's the only one that doesn't have like a special feature distinguishing it from all the other ones. And so it's a very clever kind of send up of this kind of question where you're like, well, literally any of them would be good answers. You just have to figure out why.
But I am convinced of this, Joe, and please correct me if I'm wrong. It doesn't matter what I say on the air. You're going to find something wrong with what I said.
Me personally?
Yeah,
or just
you personally.
In general?
You, Joe Heschmeyer, will find something wrong with what I said because you're you like picking on me, Joe.
A bad person.
You like picking on me.
That's fair. It goes both ways.
You seem all hurt by that. I'm only playing with you, Joe. We're going to calls now.
I want to make sure that people don't write in taking your side. I'm trying to figure out how to head that off. Like,
listen, I'll tell you right now. I will say Anne, because Anne is one of my favorite people. And you are not one of Anne's favorite people. And so when you appear on the show with me, Anne will write to defend me. And you don't have to.
Exactly.
Anne. Joe and I are good friends. But I do like Anne better than I like you. I just want you to know that.
That's fair.
And if you met her, you would like her better than you like me. 888-318-7884. Let's start with Tim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Tim, why aren't you Catholic?
I'm not Catholic because as the last three or four years, we've been leaning toward learning more and more about the Catholic Church and loving the local radio station WAOB, which stands for We Are One Body, which has a lot of silent contemplation time, which goes against a lot of the noisy radio stations that we don't appreciate in the morning. And we have visited St. Emma's Monastery in Greensburg. We like reading about the saints. And
that led you away from the Catholic Church?
No. This past weekend, I stopped by to get a bulletin. And as people were coming out of Mass, they were walking by a table that was selling lottery tickets. It was a fundraiser. They also have what is called Night at the Races once a month. And the way they raise money, I want to give the benefit of the doubt that the priest is cautioning people not to think of it as truly gambling. But the way my wife and I were raised, they wouldn't even sell singing quartet records on a Sunday. And we were cautious about that. And so my wife it was a real turnoff for her in that respect.
A little bit like the money changers in the temple?
Yes, you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joe?
Yeah, I think that's a great objection. I think let me clarify what I mean by that. I don't think that's a good reason not to be Catholic, but I do think it's a legitimate thing to grapple with and say, should that be happening or not? Because I think so often we take it for granted. You know, you get like bingo in the church hall with the old ladies, and it's kind of kind of a classic trope of that. But it's worth asking, well, if they're paying to play the bingo, is that small stakes gambling? And if it is that a problem? And you'll find Catholics who disagree on both of those questions. Some would say, you know, this is not really gambling in any real sense. You know, the person paying $5 for a bingo card or who's, you know, giving a couple bucks to a raffle, they're more doing it as a donation, or they're just paying for the enjoyment of getting to play, and they're not really doing it as like an investment strategy of like, oh, I really want to win this money, the way people will sometimes approach gambling. And then the second is that even if it is gambling, is that harmless? And it's not the gambling of itself is always and everywhere immoral. Francis de Sales, in Introduction to the Devout Life, gives a clear distinction that I think is one that we'd be right to heed, and one that we kind of don't take seriously now. He says, dice, cards, and the like games of hazard are not merely dangerous amusements like dancing, but they are plainly bad and harmful, and therefore they are forbidden by the civil as well as the ecclesiastical law. In other words, once upon a time, gambling was forbidden both by the church and by the state, but specifically games of chance, not games of skill. And he explains that these kind of games are unreasonable because the winner has neither skill nor industry to boast of, and so it's contrary to reason. And he goes on, and all of the other reasons you might expect, that there's plenty of stories of people having their lives ruined through gambling addiction and the like. I like Francis de Sales' distinction between games that require skill and games that are just purely chance. So something like a raffle, that's purely chance. Something like a slot machine is purely chance. But even like a poker game, arguably there's something closer to skill there. Someone is making money because they're good at kind of reading other people, or they're good at kind of playing the room. That looks more like an ordinary job, frankly. That looks more like people who invest in the stock market or who fill in the blank. Like, if we were to say that any kind of investment where there's uncertainty is immoral, well, then we would have to really shut down much of the modern economy. And I don't think that's something you'll find a clear warrant for in Scripture or in the church's tradition. So all that's to say, I agree with you that I think a raffle is a bad idea. I think it's a small bad idea because I don't think anyone's losing big sums of money. But I think it's something that we'd be good to take to heart because it's something we tend to overlook as Catholics. But none of that, I think, should stop you from becoming a Catholic. You can object to the parish raffle and still believe Jesus founded the church.
I agree.
Okay, I wanted to come back to you, see what you thought about that. Okay.
I really like it. I'll talk to my wife more about it.
I wonder too if some of these things have been maintained despite the fact of great sociological changes. That is, in the say the 1920s at a Catholic parish, if there was bingo night, that was a social night for everybody as much as anything because it was the parishioners who were coming and they were hanging out together, having fun. It was a couple bucks, but that was just But now it's people who are. Not associated with the parish in many places. It's just like the parish running a gambling hall. So it's a different thing than it was maybe 100 years ago.
I see. Some leftovers.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, I don't know. I wonder what Joe thinks about that.
I think that's exactly right. And I tried to allude to that earlier. I mean, think about it this way. If you go to see a speaker, and let's say there's a cost for the ticket to go see the speaker, but the speaker has a door prize, and so somebody wins a door prize. You're probably not saying, I'm going to buy a lot of tickets so I can like triple my chances of, winning the door prize or something like that. You're not treating it like gambling, even though you're investing some money and you might get a reward at the end. You're going for other reasons. And I think if you approach something like bingo or parish raffle or fill in the blank in that spirit, that's not really the spirit of gambling. But I think you're right that a lot of places, even if they started off innocuously like that, it can become something that's not of a Christian spirit. I'd say for all of the reasons we've kind of discussed so far, and then sometimes you'll also get just a spirit of drunkenness, we'll say, just to put it very bluntly. You know, some of these parish events, they're a little too free with the beer. The wine and parishioners overindulge. And I think it's something to be on the lookout for from a Christian perspective of any kind.
Excellent.
Thank you. And I really appreciate the call because it's something that we don't talk enough about internally as Catholics about, well, how does this look to people from the outside? Because we might say, oh, it's all a bunch of harmless fun and it brings in some dollars for the, you know, the parish school or something. And parish schools are constantly, you know, struggling. But it does have another side to it as well. Like the person who comes and goes, wait a second, what are these Catholics all about? So I appreciate the call. We got to take a quick break. The number is 888-318-7884. Why aren't you Catholic? Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. If you'd like to talk about why you're not Catholic, give us a call. 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Wherever you are in the world, you can access the EWTN Global Catholic Network. It's everywhere. You can get EWTN's great Catholic programming on your car radio, at home on your TV, computer, or smart speaker. With EWTN's app, you can take EWTN everywhere, on your phone or mobile device. If you want your news in print, turn to EWTN's paper of record, the National Catholic Register. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, both hours today, and we'd like to talk with non-Catholics today. If you're not a Catholic and you want to talk with us, give us a call. Tell us why you're not Catholic. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Maybe you're not Catholic because you feel you have found something better. Maybe you are not Catholic because you're not convinced by Catholic arguments. Maybe you're not Catholic for some other reason, and we can maybe help you with it, or we can just have a good conversation. We love those. 888-318-7884. And we publish a lot here at Catholic Answers, and we sell it all over at shop.catholic.com. And right now is our annual spring sale at shop.catholic.com. It's store-wide. Everything's on sale, 10 to 25% off in some cases more. And you can get $5 shipping on your whole order. So order as much as you want at these sale prices and then get $5 shipping on the whole thing. Just head over to shop.catholic.com. I'm reluctant to read that ad because our last caller said he wasn't Catholic because he thought we were a little bit too forward about looking for the filthy lucre, and here I am asking you to go shop it. But we're a lay apostolate, and we support ourselves by publishing things. That's one of the ways we support ourselves, and you can get all, and we think it's good, helpful stuff. We have Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. 888-318-7884 is the number to call here. If you want to find us online and get those great deals, just head over to shop.catholic.com. Joe, thanks again for taking the time to be with us for these 2 hours. I didn't realize that you had been traveling so much. So you go to Ohio to see Matt Frad. I heard Matt Frad was, this is truly what I heard. And then I'm going to the caller, but I just want to ask you about this. I heard that he was over in Ukraine or something.
He was in Poland, actually.
Oh, Poland.
Near the Ukrainian border. One of the reasons I'm not actually complaining about like being tired or jet lagged is that Matt went to Poland, had come back, did like a couple shows, one in the morning and then one in the evening with me. And then yesterday he flew down to Florida. So it sounded like, he's just been on planes a lot.
Yeah.
But it was beautiful. Like he got to help, an orphanage of the hearing impaired, like deaf children.
Wow.
They delivered a bunch of food to them. And yeah, it was one of these situations. They had a connection with a priest and somebody chartered a plane. And I don't know, it was an incredible really show of support. And I think people really chipped in to help out Ukrainians who were in need and were coming across the border.
Good for Matt. So your show, I forget, does he record it live? Can you already get it over at
Pints with Aquinas? He does both. He does pre-records, but we did live. And so you are one of like 11,000 people. No, 11,000 people have seen it, but I guess not you actually, since you asked that question. So In fairness, it was during your own show. So,
also, I wouldn't have watched that otherwise. Anyways,
fair enough.
I'm sorry, Joe. Darn it, I was trying to resist. I was trying so hard to resist.
I was just teed it up there, seeing what was going to happen. I got to make sure that I look like the innocent victim and not vice versa.
I know. Get everybody, including Ann, on your side. The number is 888-318-7884. Three of our six lines are open right now. If you're not Catholic, we'd love to hear why you're not Catholic. We're going to go now to David in North Carolina, listening on 540 AM. Happy to have you, David. Why aren't you Catholic?
Well, I was telling you, screener, I was raised Catholic, but about 30 years ago, I married a Methodist, and so I've been practicing Methodist. I've been studying the Jewish, I don't know if you want to call them religion or people, and if Christ was a Jew, and why don't we know more about the Jew? Why aren't we all Jews instead of Catholics, Methodists, Protestants, Lutherans, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, okay, those are a couple of great questions. So the first is, Judaism has built in this messianic expectation. That is, if you read the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, there is this anticipation for and explicit prophecies about the coming of the Messiah. And one of those prophecies that's really interesting involves the Second Temple. So you've got the First Temple built by Solomon, it gets destroyed. There's a second temple that's sin built. And in Malachi, God promises that he himself will enter the temple. And that is apparently in some different way than he was already in the temple. And so the whole message of Jesus of Nazareth is that he is the fulfillment of Israel's messianic expectation and hope, and that he is the God of Israel come to visit his people, come to enter his temple, and to take possession of his people. And In fulfilling that messianic expectation and hope, he also opens the doors to salvation for the Gentiles and opens the doors to the church for the Gentiles. Because as far back as Abraham, God promised that through Abraham, all nations would be blessed. In other words, that this whole series of promises, the choosing of the Jews and the people of God, the Abrahamic, you know, because even before they're Jews, you've got the Israelites, that all of that is not just for their own personal good. It's also for the good of their Gentile neighbors. It's also for the good of all of us. And so Christianity is the fulfillment of that. So that's why we're not all just Jews. We are the new Israel, as St. Paul and others say. Because new Israel in the sense that it's not like we got rid of Israel, got rid of Judaism, and like scrapped it in favor of another thing, but rather that it was always heading towards having a Messiah and having the doors open for the Gentiles. Those promises are found throughout the Old Testament. Isaiah 66 talks about the nations coming to worship God. Malachi 1:11 talks about the true sacrifice being offered by the nations, that is, by the Gentiles around the world. That all of this is, that's not some crazy new thing that Jesus invents. This was the expectation the whole time, whether people understood it or not. These are what the promises were. So Christianity is a fulfillment of the promises made to the Israelites. And so we live in an era in which God has fulfilled those promises. He has more promises yet to be fulfilled until the, you know, the second coming and the culmination of all things. But that's why we're not just, you know, still waiting for the Messiah. He's here. To the second question of, like, why be Catholic instead of Methodist? Well, I'd say the simplest reason is that Jesus promises to build a church, and he doesn't build the Methodist church. You know, John Wesley does that. Jesus Christ builds the Catholic church. And there's a bunch of other reasons. The Eucharist, the structure of the church, the nature of what the church is. But I think in terms of just a simple answer, that's what I would say.
I just want to see, what do you think about that? Does that make sense to you?
It makes a lot of sense. He answers a lot of great questions that I have. But in the Old Testament, says God said that 10 Gentiles will come to a Jew and say, "Take us with you, for you have God." And where in the Old Testament does God say that He's going to come in as a man? And if you believe in the 10 Commandments, God keeps saying, "There's only me. There's only me. There's only me. There is nobody else. Don't believe anybody else. It's just me. I'm not coming in as a man." And so that's just a little confusing there.
Yeah, no. You're absolutely right. There's no other God than God. Jesus isn't some second God. Like, that's not the nature of the Trinity. But in terms of the Messianic prophecies, including the Messiah being God, you have some that are more subtle hints. The promise that both gold and frankincense will be offered to the Messiah. Gold is what you give to a king. Frankincense is the sacrificial incense you give to God. It's what you put on a sacrifice. But then you also have places like Isaiah 9, verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. That's about as explicit as it gets, that the Messiah who is to come will be revered and honored and worshipped as God, not just as, you know, as David or as a mighty king. And then you have other places, the psalmist saying, the Lord says to my Lord. Jesus points out that this makes it very clear that there is a God of Jacob who's also a son of Jacob.
David, thanks. You probably hear the music.
You guys are awesome.
Thank you, David. You are as well. If you want to hang on, we'll send you a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Maybe that will be of interest to you and of help to you. And I'd love to hear from you again. We'll be right back with more Why Aren't You Catholic? On Catholic Answers Live. Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Sarah's running the board. Edgar's on the phones. Mary's on the video. And we're just happy you're here. And we really are happy you're here. We appreciate that you take the time with us. And we're asking you, if you're Catholic, to hang on, though, because today we want to talk to non-Catholics about why you are not Catholic. If you're not a Catholic, you know, maybe you're like, I've always wanted to, you know, tell a Catholic about, you know, why that these Catholic beliefs are wrong. That would be a good motivation to call us. Or maybe you're curious about something Catholic and you're like, this has always kept me out. Whatever. If you're not a Catholic, we'd love to hear from you and have that conversation. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Listening on 740 AM, Julian is in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thanks, Julian, for the call. Why aren't you Catholic?
Well, every time you say something like the early church was a Catholic church, it makes my stomach boil. It really does.
Joe said it. That was Joe.
I know Joe said that.
Okay, all right.
I hear that.
Because I don't want to boil your stomach.
But here's my question. So right before Paul left the earth, died, he said that grievous wolves will come and destroy the church and spread all kinds of heresies. And he also said that there will be antichrists. Many antichrists will come. Now, antichrist, from the angle of not particularly against Christ, but in place of Christ. And so I see that the Catholic Church has put itself in place of Christ, and therefore Christ is sort of like in the background over there. His mother is elevated, and all the other things that the Catholic Church is known for.
Okay, how about this? I want to come back to you, Julian, because that was a lot of very interesting points. Let's get Joe's reaction to that about the church being the Antichrist, and then we'll go back to Julian and we'll have a little conversation. Joe, what do you make of that?
Can I actually ask a clarifying question?
Sure.
When does this Antichrist church replace the real church in Julian's view? Or Julian, in your view?
Well, the Antichrist, the word Antichrist, doesn't necessarily mean against Christ. But it also means in place of Christ, meaning the church puts itself on the throne of Christ and have, you know, the...
Right. But I mean, historically, when do you think that happens?
Oh, right after the last saint died.
Oh, wow.
After Paul died and all of that.
So you think the gates of hell just like immediately overtake the church?
It was a slow thing. It was a slow death to choose.
Well, I guess I'm trying to pin down. It sounds like immediately after the death of the last apostle, doesn't sound like a slow death at all. I mean, if we say Christianity only lasts 70 years, I mean, think back 70 years from now. That was not very long. That would be a pretty failed movement. I guess so. I've got a few thoughts about what you're saying. The first is, you're absolutely right that St. Paul says in Acts 20:29, I know that after my departure, fierce wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock, and from among your own selves will arise men speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after them. But then he tells them to therefore be alert. In other words, the notice to the church is to be traditional, to not accept any new teaching. Like, the reason that as Catholics we reject Protestantism is we know where Protestantism comes from, and it's not from the first century. It's from the 16th century, or depending on the denomination, even later than that. And St. Paul tells us to watch out for that. Like, if someone comes along and starts teaching something new, that's a big red flag. And so St. Jerome makes the point that if you can trace where any Christian denomination comes from, and it's not to Jesus Christ, then you know it's not the true church. You know it's not the church founded by Christ. You know it's one of the ones that we're warned about in Scripture. So I like that you're on the lookout, because St. Paul tells us to be. But I think you've made a mistake in throwing out the one church that can claim to go back to the time of Christ. Second, your concern is that the church is putting itself in the place of Christ. But in actual fact, St. Paul says that the church is the continuation of Christ. So in Ephesians 1, he says that God, in verse 22, he says that God has put all things under Christ's feet and has made him the head over all things for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. In other words, the beauty of Christianity is that God takes on a body for the first time. That's the mystery of the incarnation. The second person of the Trinity takes to himself humanity. He takes a human body. And Paul's point is that even after Christ is ascended into heaven, the incarnation continues on in the church, which is the fullness of Christ who fills all in all. That's what he says. That's explicitly there, Ephesians 1:23. So the church isn't putting herself in the place of Christ. She's saying she is the body of Christ, that she is the bride of Christ, and the two become one flesh, that she is totally united with Christ, such that to separate her from Christ would be like taking the head off of a body, or trying to divorce a lawful union between man and wife who've become one. It's impossible, and it would be a sort of spiritual decapitation. That's not us replacing Christ. That's us being, the fullness of Christ, head and members, head and body. And then finally, this idea that the church immediately falls into apostasy and error would totally invalidate Christianity. In other words, if that really happened, that would be a great argument against Christianity. Go back to the book of Acts, and Gamaliel makes this challenge. And he points out that there are all of these people, or Gamaliel, I guess is how people pronounce it. He points out there are all these messianic movements, and the false ones peter out, and they end. And so if Christianity is the real deal, it has to survive. It has to survive for more than a generation, because that's what distinguishes it from a false messianic movement. You can find this in Acts 5, beginning in verse 34. He says, if this plan or undertaking is of men, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. So if you say that the devil overthrew the church and then the Antichrist replaced the true church, the logical consequence of that is you have to say Jesus isn't really the Christ, because the real Christ will have a church not overcome by the gates of hell.
Okay, so Julian, what do you make of all that?
Well, I hear all Joe is saying, but here's the problem. The church did not disappear. What the church did, it went underground for the 1,260 years that the Catholic Church reigned, during what we call as Protestants the Dark Ages. So during those 1,260 years, and again, according to the Book of Revelation, the church went underground while the false church of the Christ system reigned for that time.
Wow.
So I think there's two problems with that kind of theory. The first is that there's just literally no historical evidence for an underground church for 1,260 years. But the second is that Jesus explicitly tells the church, you are the light of the world, and a city set on a hill cannot be hid, Matthew 5:14. And he tells them to go out and make disciples of all nations. I mean, historically, it's the Catholic Church who's evangelizing Europe, the Catholic Church evangelizing North Africa, the Catholic Church evangelizing into India. This so-called true church that failed to live out what Christ said to do doesn't look or sound like the true church. They're not a light of the world. They're not a city set on a hill. They apparently not only can be hid, they decide to be hidden, and they're not living out the great evangelization for more than 1,000 years. Like that, if such a group of Christians did exist, we could know definitively they were a false church. The true church, Christ says in Matthew 13, is like a mustard seed that flourishes, it flowers, it grows into a mustard tree, the largest of all of the plants in the garden. And so the true church explodes in size, and all the persecutions in the world are unable to stop true Christianity, the Catholic Church, from growing into the largest church in the world and the largest church in all of history.
Julian? Did we lose Julian, or what's up? Oh, hang on, Julian. Julian, did you want to respond to what Joe said?
Well, I would say the church was hiding in underground for its survival. And so we look at the Waldensian Christians, who the false church or the Antichrist church persecuted, and they had to go underground, just like the church is hidden right now in places like China and places where they're being persecuted. You cannot tell me that the churches in those countries that's been persecuted are not shining their lights. Actually, their lights are shining even brighter.
Oh, I agree that the churches in those places have their lights are definitely shining, but those are real places. We know of the Christians in China. There's plenty of historical evidence that they exist. The kind of imaginary invisible church for 1,260 years, there's no record of any such church existing because it's not real. If you go back and read like the early controversies within early Christianity, you've got conflicts from the Catholics against like the Gnostics or against the Donatists or various other groups, but there's no Catholics against like the Protestants in the early church. There's nobody who looks and sounds like a Baptist or an Adventist or fill in the blank. Those people just, they don't exist. And I would say if like the person claiming that they do, that there's a 1,260 year history, should be able to point to that, because we can point to the history of the underground church in China. We can show that that church exists and that it's doing good work on the ground, even if it is, as you rightly point out, doing it often very quietly. It is still living out this goal of being a city on a hill, still living out the goal of evangelizing all nations, even at the risk of their own life. A church that failed to do that, that just literally just for the sake of its own survival didn't evangelize, would be effectively an apostate church, because it would just fail to be living out Jesus's message by valuing their physical safety over the power of the gospel.
I would just love to continue this conversation, but every single line is full, Julian, so I'm going to have to leave it there, and maybe some more, maybe others will follow up with some other points related to your argument. I don't know, but this is such a fruitful and helpful conversation. I'd love to send you a book. I don't know if you want a book from us, because Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, actually boiled your stomach. And I know how
well,
that
the title,
feels.
The title. Maybe the title. You should read the book and see.
Well,
if
I'll send
he
him the book.
Agrees or disagrees. Yeah.
But if he doesn't want it, what's one of our lesser titles? Let's send him A Teacher of Strange Things, who Jesus was, what he taught, and why people still follow him. It's a minor title that we have.
Who wrote that one?
Well, I mean, it's a minor title, but I got a major author. Major author. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. We've got every single line full with folks who are not Catholic and want to tell us why they're not Catholic. We're super grateful for those calls, so I don't want to keep you waiting. Right back with more Why Aren't You Catholic? With Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
There are some people who are super imminent. Now, the most imminent example would clearly be the person of Moses, as such a luminescent character, reflecting the divine glory, that the Israelites could not physically look at him.
Wow.
The man had to veil his face because he was like this giant walking light bulb.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders, tonight, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I think I'm doing a very good job just serving the caller and the listener today and not getting involved in trivial arguments with Joe Heschmeyer, which is one of the most fun things to do. I don't ever want to get in a serious argument with Joe Heschmeyer because he'll beat me. But if I can keep it on the grounds of triviality, I feel like I can hold my own as a trivial and maybe even slightly petulant person. I feel like I can hold my own against you, Joe.
I invite the back and forth. I enjoy it, but you're right that it makes for bad radio. So for the sake of everyone else.
All right, Alex in Kansas, listening to EWTN. And I say Kansas like that because that's where Joe is. Listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM satellite radio. Thanks for the call, Alex. Why aren't you Catholic?
You're doing an excellent job, by the way, Cy.
Oh, I like Alex. Free book coming, Alex.
Kansas are too nice. That's the problem.
They're not too nice. They're just nice.
Yeah, we're just nice. It's just ontologically part of our state of being.
Right.
Exactly. Amen.
Right.
Amen.
And I don't want to say what's ontologically part of our California state of being. It's something different.
Well,
are you guys making
there.
A state pun when you say state of being?
Oh.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you did there with what I did there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right.
So I would say the primary reason I'm not Catholic or I'm not convinced of becoming a Roman Catholic is because I don't think that the Vatican I understanding of the papacy is coherent with what the apostles would have understood and what the church fathers taught.
That's a very clear, very... strong argument. I'm going to tell you, Alex, I think that's the best argument against Catholicism in this sense. If the church is right about the papacy, everybody should be Catholic. And if the church is wrong about the papacy, nobody should be Catholic. Like, that's the real make or break kind of issue.
Somebody should write a book about that, Joe.
Yeah, I mentioned that in the first chapter of my book, Pope Peter, that looks at the historic claim of the papacy, not just in like the first few centuries, but specifically in the first century with Saint Peter. What's the understanding? What's the biblical evidence for the papacy? But in your view, Alex, when do you see the papacy arising?
The Vatican I.
Like, who's the first pope? Yeah, who's the first pope?
Well, and again, that's going to depend on how we define it, because again, I'm not convinced of the Vatican I understanding. I am convinced of the first among equals, so I would definitely say it would have been Peter. And going with what Szczesinski says, I think that Rome had a primacy because of its political position and the fact that Peter and Paul both died in that city. And so for me, a first among equals is not a problem. I think that after Vatican I, there is a substantial departure from that, though.
Okay. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Do you give the what they call the primacy of honor that the Eastern theologians
yes.
speak of? Okay.
Yeah.
So the original understanding of primacy of honor doesn't just mean honor in the way we use the term today. It meant like authority, that honor was a synonym for authority. And it was a recognition, not of like dignity, but in much more, maybe I guess the way sort of that we use it with judges when we say your honor, it's a respect for an office, it's a respect for a certain position. And so a primacy of honor in this sense, in the earliest sense, actually meant that the Bishop of Rome, the successor of Peter, had a unique authority that nobody else had. But I'd rather just focus on the biblical stuff, if you're good with that. I would start with Luke 22. I know Catholics like to start with Matthew 16, and I love Matthew 16. But in Luke 22, at the Last Supper, the apostles are arguing about which of them is the greatest. And rather than discourage this, Jesus tells them what Christian greatness consists of, that he holds up himself as the model and says that true greatness is to serve. And so he lays out what we call servant leadership today. And then he affirms the apostolic nature of the church and says that the U12 will be, you were with me in my trials, you'll have thrones judging the 12 tribes. And then he singles out in the very next verse one of the 12 and says, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you, that's you all, or you plural, that he might sift you all like wheat. But then he switches from the plural to the singular and says, but I've prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brethren. In other words, he's just said servant leadership is what Christian leadership and authority looks like, and that the apostles have this and will always have this in the church, even into heaven. They'll always have this kind of servant leadership authority. And then he says to one of them that he's got this servant leadership authority even in relation to the other 11 with the line, strengthen your brethren. That in the face of demonic assault on the entire apostolic foundation of the church and demonic assault on all 12, Jesus singularly prays for one of them, Simon Peter, and strengthens his faith so he can strengthen that of the rest. That, I think, is everything you need to hold to the Catholic claim in terms of Peter having a unique and special role, and one that predates anything about like Roman political importance or anything like that. That there's something in the role of Peter and then continues on with his successors. What do you think of that idea, Alex? Does that jive? Does that make sense?
I don't think that's a good or bad argument. I think it's just a good argument for the safety of the church. I mean, because it includes the other apostles and it includes Peter himself. And yeah, we can talk about the fact that Peter is the head, but it is the certainty that just like what Jesus says in Matthew 16, the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. And so for me, that passage, though, we could argue, yeah, you know what it talks about, we could emphasize the importance of Peter in that. It doesn't get me to that Vatican I position that I'm concerned about. I'm completely
is there
in agreement.
Something with particularly within the Vatican I definition? Like what specifically about the Vatican I understanding of the papacy? Because it seems like Peter's not just one among equals here. He seems to be giving a unique authority. So is there something more that Vatican I offers that you say, I don't see that part?
Well, and I would just say on the unique authority, Paul was given a unique authority to preach to the Gentiles. So a unique authority does not entail being the head of the church.
No, I agree with you that a unique authority doesn't entail being the head of the church. I think that's a misreading of Galatians 1 to say Paul's given a unique authority. When he calls himself an apostle to the Gentiles, he's not saying Peter's not allowed to preach to Gentiles. That goes contrary to Paul's entire message, and Peter's the first to preach to the Gentiles. But I do think you're right that someone can have a unique role in the church, and that doesn't mean they're the head. my point was that Peter's unique role is to be the servant leader of the other servant leaders. And that's why I'm saying he seems to be given a unique headship.
Yeah, well, no, and I would agree with that. I just don't think it gets to the Vatican I position, because I think when you get to Vatican I, you have a pope that cannot err. And I think Pope Honorius is a great example of a pope that certainly did err. And I would not say that he was a heretic and that his failures were a proof that the church collapsed. But any bishop can err, and it is through the Holy Spirit working through other bishops that they are brought back. And so that's what I would say about Luke 22, is that Peter had a specific mission to restore the other apostles, and Christ restored him. But that's not a proof or a disproof for the papacy. That to me is a proof that he had a specific role and task.
I see. That makes sense. When we're talking about infallibility, I want to agree with you that just like Pope Honorius, just like, you know, St. Peter in Galatians 2, you know, this whole encounter in Antioch that St. Paul recounts, popes can and do err. Papal infallibility, despite its name, doesn't actually mean the pope can't err, or that there's no role bishops may have in drawing the pope back if he makes a mistake. And I think you're absolutely right with that. And I think we see that even in the modern world where, you know, if Pope Francis says something, other bishops may speak up and say, you need to clarify this, or what do you mean by that? Or, you know, and we see popes even today speaking out. All of that's totally compatible with Vatican I's understanding of papal infallibility. That understanding is just that when the pope defines a doctrine, that definition is infallible. Not that the pope himself, like, in everything he says and does. Does that distinction help? Does that make sense? Because nothing in Vatican I is contrary to the possibility of Honorius deciding something wrongly in the course of his pontificate.
That distinction helps. I definitely do appreciate that. I think you still have an issue, though, with can a pope determine a church council, or is it the church council that determines what's doctrine? Because I know that we've had church councils that popes did not preside over and did not say were de facto part of the faith. And I'm thinking it was the 6th or 7th ecumenical council that the pope did not preside over and had nothing to say about. And it was only later that he said, yeah, this is right. But the church never said, oh, thank goodness, because the pope has said that this is acceptable and part of the doctrine, we can get along with ourselves, because the Orthodox have been getting along just fine. And I put that in air quotes, just fine, as they're having their own issues. But they've gotten along just fine for the last 1,000 years.
Yeah, I think that you're right to have the air quotes there. The Orthodox actually have some confusion about how many councils there are. And the source of that confusion is that they have no principle by which to determine which is and isn't a valid council. So the instances I would point you to, there are two. The so-called Second Council of Ephesus, which is better known as the Robber Council, and then the Council of Chalcedon. So in 449, the Second Council of Ephesus is convened, and it is heretical. But it has all of the auspices of being a true ecumenical council, except that the papal legate just says one word, contradictor, where he rebukes the entire council and goes home, and the pope declares it a robber council, not a true council. And neither the East nor the West accepts it today. But the only reason that anyone can really point to is that Pope Leo doesn't accept it. And instead, the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which is Orthodox, which is the basic... Chalcedonian Christianity is something that Catholics, Orthodox, and Protestants are all united on. That's something that the Pope has a huge role in what's called the Tome of Leo. And there they read that this letter that the Pope has written and say that the Apostle Peter has spoken through Leo. And so there's very much this role that, not that the Pope has to make every decision at the council, of course not, but rather that if the Pope says X isn't a valid council, it's not a valid council in either the East or the West. And that's very hard to explain away historically, except by reference to this unique authority that the Bishop of Rome has always had.
Alex, we've got to leave it there. I think if you'd like it, I'd love to send you a copy of Joe's book, Pope Peter, defending the church's most distinctive doctrine in a time of crisis. If you'd like it, just hang on the line. Edgar will get your information and we'll send it to Kansas. And if you're on the line, please stay on the line because Joe's going to stay with us for another hour. So, and I had so many great calls coming up. Really would like to get to everybody. We asked you to call if you're not Catholic, and some folks have been generous enough to take us up on that invitation. And I don't want to lose anybody. Really want to have those conversations. So hang on. We'll be right back with more Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live and a bunch of callers who have called to tell us why they are not Catholic. Right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.